ESRI's report, which was published yesterday, did reveal that the COVID-19 pandemic resulted in poorer mental health among young adults. 4 in 10, 41% 22-year-old men, and over half, 55% of 22-year-old women were classified as depressed. They were much higher figures than the 2 years previously, when 22% of men and 31% of women were depressed. One of the report's authors, Emer Smith, went through the findings with us yesterday afternoon. But later on yesterday, the organisation Turn to Me, the national mental health charity, has did release a press release, you know, urging the public to use its services following the report publication. And I am joined now by the chief executive of Turn to Me, that is Fiona O'Malley. Hello, Fiona.
Hello, thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you for joining me. I mentioned yourselves, you're a national mental health charity. You're urging people to use the free mental health services, and free being one of the operative words there, because we're in a cost of living crisis. So many people's mental health has suffered. Probably, you know, the majority of people's mental health has suffered due to the pandemic. And unfortunately, many people, even if they can afford it, cannot book appointments. And others, as I'm saying, simply just cannot afford it. It's completely out of possibility, unfortunately, for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one of the other big complaints in the mental health sector, if people can afford it, as you say, there are really long waiting lists. We've heard of people having waiting lists for up to a year to access mental health services. So our services are free, and two of our services, our Thoughtcatcher and our support groups, don't have any waiting lists. So you can sign up for our services and within an hour you can be posting on the Thoughtcatcher, or you can sign up for one of our support groups. And the support groups are run by mental health professionals who have a lot of experience and who are qualified to discuss these issues. So we would certainly encourage anyone in the public who would be in that bracket that is mentioned in the ESRI report, or people who are just feeling down and who feel like they either can't afford good professional mental health services, or they don't want to be waiting for the waiting list, or you know they don't want to join those very long waiting lists, then they can access our free services. And as I said, two of them, our support groups and our Thoughtcatcher, have no waiting list, so they can be used by anyone in Ireland and they can be accessed immediately.
And Fiona, how can one get in touch with yourselves at Turn to Me, and what are the age categories you cater for?
Yeah, that's a great question. We cater for two different age categories. We cater for young people aged 12 to 17, and we also cater for adults over the age of 18. And I suppose whilst the ESRI report, the results are quite shocking, they are reflective of what a lot of mental health professionals witnessed and reported during the pandemic. For example, the demand for Turn to Me services significantly increased during the lockdown. In fact, at the peak of the lockdown, demand for our services spiked by 386%. So we're urging anyone who is experiencing anxiety, depression, grief or relationship issues to sign up for our support groups, and people can do that by going to our website, which is turntome.ie.
I just think people will find it so hard to get their head around the fact that there's no waiting lists here. I know you've mentioned it three times, but I just feel like it has to be reiterated, because as you say, so many people who can afford to pay for, you know, mental health appointments or psychiatrists, therapists, counsellors, whatever it may be, unfortunately do have to wait a long time. And that's one of the key issues when it comes to anything to do with your health, whether that's physical or mental, is that wait time.
Yeah, absolutely. And it goes without saying that obviously these issues can be exacerbated the longer they're unaddressed and the longer people are left waiting. And particularly if someone is in distress or feeling particularly low, you know, heightened feelings of anxiety can come about from just the concept of the waiting list alone. So we would encourage anyone who's feeling depressed or who's feeling anxious and who does not want to face either the cost or the waiting list that is associated with some mental health services to avail of our free our support groups and our Thoughtcatcher. And one of the interesting things that we hear back from some of our users, they kind of say, oh, you know, my anxiety is bad, but like it's not that bad, or, you know, I do suffer from depression. profession, but there are people out there who are suffering worse than me. Our services, it's not a pie. So just because you take up one slot doesn't mean you're taking away that slot from someone else. Our support groups, they can facilitate up to 50, up to 100 people per support group, and it's all online. So I just would hate for anyone to think that, you know, they would feel that, you know, they don't want to sign up for these services because they might take it away from someone who they believe needs it more than them. But we firmly believe that early intervention is the best preventative measure. So even if you're feeling, you know, low levels of anxiety, or like your depression might flare up now and again, it's always a good time to seek mental health support.
Yeah.
And
a lot of the time,
no waiting for those services, and we would encourage people not to wait as well.
A lot of the time it is people who really need help, that they have this feeling that they're undeserving and that they shouldn't reach out for help, and there's people worse. And it is that saying that goes around, isn't it, that, you know, oh, there's always someone worse off than you, or stop complaining or whatever. But really, the only way to help others is to help yourself first. So that's the message you want to get out there time and time again, as so many other mental health organisations want to do so. So it's great highlighting that, because I think so many people feel isolated when they feel undeserving, and they just don't feel worth, you know, reaching out for help. You've mentioned this thought catcher a few times. I just want you to give me a bit more detail. I'm on the website at the moment.
Yeah.
So it's peer support, and it's worded here on the website as, use the thought catcher as your daily mood diary. Select your mood, mm-hmm. share your feelings anonymously, and track your mood changes. You can react and share with people who are experiencing similar challenges. So is it like a social media platform, but I'm assuming you can't just post whatever you want to others?
That is an excellent summary of it. Yeah. So we all know it's a very ugly and toxic place, and people can leave very hurtful and harmful comments. So it is an online platform, the Thought Catcher. It runs every day from 2 p.m. until 8 p.m. And people, as you say, can talk about how they're feeling, and other people can respond with positive, uplifting messages. But the difference between the Thought Catcher and any like other just random social media sites is that the Thought Catcher is monitored. So there are professional moderators that go in and make sure that all the comments are supportive and uplifting, because we can't, you know, have hateful or hurtful comments on a mental health service. So users can engage with the Thought Catcher and the support groups for free. They're funded by the HSE's National Office for Suicide Prevention. And what's quite interesting about the Thought Catcher is, as you say, it's a form of peer support. And when people engage in peer support, obviously, you know, the person who's at the receiving end of those comments, be them, you know, supportive or be them kind of uplifting messages, they can obviously benefit from it. But the people who are giving those messages, they also report positive
feel good factor, I guess.
Yeah. So it's really, really interesting what the research shows. I suppose it's nearly like when you give a gift to someone, you yourself feel good as well.
So true. That's actually one of my favorite things to do, is to buy people presents, genuinely. Because it does, like, I do like to see them happy, but it's so true. You also get something out of it. In terms of peer support, does it mean that the Thought Catcher is broken down into different age groups? Like, it's only people between the age of, is it a 5-year window that you're speaking to? How does it work?
Yeah, absolutely. So people who are between the ages of 12 and 17, they are directed to one Thought Catcher, and then there's Thought Catcher for adults, because obviously the way someone who is age 12 or 13 or 14, the way they would communicate and interact would be different. The tone would be very different to you know, a chat group or a Thought Catcher platform for adults. So we need to facilitate for both those age groups, and that's why we have the two different categories. So when people are engaging with a Thought Catcher, it really is, you know, peers, people of the same age, and, you know, probably who are going through something similar.
You mentioned a moment ago that the service did spike, that the highest point it reached was an increase of 386% earlier on in the pandemic. How could the service handle that, such a big spike?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I suppose the demand for any service scale up in a very short period of time can be quite difficult. So I suppose you know, every organisation needs to be a bit adaptive and try to facilitate the demand as much as possible. I suppose our platform, our online platform, is different to maybe some other mental health services because all of our services are run on the platform. So the one-to-one counselling sessions are run on the platform, the support groups are run on the platform, and the thought catcher are run on the platform. And that means that we don't have the issues with traditional bricks and mortar of either rent or people travelling to and from mental health services. It's all built into the platform. So scaling things up and scaling things down in terms of meeting the demand, that's something that we're able to do quite fluidly with the website because the services are online.
Well, I advise anybody out there to head to the website. I'm on it at the moment and I just want to note a couple of things. The one-to-one counselling, for example, you literally just click on that on the website and there's an apply now button. That's for anybody over the age of 18. It notes offers support for whatever you're going through. Six sessions, Fiona notes here. Does that mean six sessions altogether?
That means all together, yeah. So people can avail of up to six free sessions of our one-to-one counselling sessions if they're resident in Ireland.
Six sessions for the one-to-one counselling?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then the support groups or the thought catcher, you can use as many times as you want. There's no cap on those.
Okay. And obviously, you know, charities like yourself do rely on donations, I'm sure. And if people do wish to donate, they can do so. You can also set up your own little account here. And it's just, again, click of a button, create a free account now. And very simple, Fiona, as people can imagine what they go through. So it's turn2me.ie to find out a lot more information there. And with yesterday's report from the ESRI, charities like Turn to Me, you know, advocating and I guess reiterating the fact that they want people to come forward and use the services. Cost of living crisis, so many people can't afford these things. You can get up to six free counselling sessions, one-to-one counselling. You can do it on your device. You know, you don't have to travel somewhere. It's something that I think anybody would want to reach out for if they possibly can and they need help in any way. So head over to turntome.ie to find out more information. Thank you so much to the Chief Executive, Fiona O'Malley. Since Ukraine was invaded on the 24th of February this year, it's estimated that approximately 36,000 Ukrainian refugees now live in Ireland after they felt forced to abandon their homes. An online survey was conducted by Ukrainian Action in Ireland and it has revealed the challenges some refugees are facing. The survey was completed by almost 2,200 adults, but when their children are counted, it amounts to more than 4,400 people, or 13% of the total population of Ukrainians in Ireland. I'm joined now by the co-founding director of Ukrainian Action in Ireland, and that's Olena Redruhina. Thank you so much for joining me this afternoon, Olena. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me, Kira. Thank you.
We greatly appreciate it. And going through these issues or topics that were noted, in particular, problems around the banking and taxation system, the language barriers, public transport and shared accommodation have all been expressed through this survey. Despite the trauma of war, it does appear that the Ukrainians are confident in their mental health, which is absolutely amazing. Just speaking about mental health there a few minutes ago with my last guest, Fiona O'Malley, half the respondents said they do not need psychological support, but just over 15% are seeking a therapist. Now, 90% of respondents did write messages of support when asked, what do you want to say to the Irish government? Some of those messages, Olena, as people can imagine, very, very emotional. One person said, my house is ruined. Myself and my baby are so grateful. I stopped crying when I arrived here. I thought my life was over. I never expected this level of support. It's so great for the Irish people to hear responses like that.
Yes, and we were just fascinated to understand that this is the main message that actually we've heard from people, because when we started the survey, we we knew the main challenges, and I think it's fair to expect certain challenges in a situation like that. But that question, the question, what would you like to say to Irish people and Irish government, it was an open question. So people honestly could say anything. And then when we started to receive those replies and when we've been processing them and, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of messages saying exactly the same thing, just in different words, I just want to reiterate this, and I just want to say that that was the main message by Ukrainians, the gratitude, the overwhelming gratitude.
Well, it's pretty amazing for you to say so. Olena, if I ask you about your own story, you're the co-founding director of Ukrainian Action in Ireland. Have you been in this country prior to the invasion, or was it since the 24th of February you travelled here?
No, I've been here for 8 years, and actually we find that it's quite challenging for people fleeing the war to be active in some, let's say, in some response activities. You know, it's more they need help rather than they can participate in something. We still find some amazing examples of people fleeing the war, and they still want to volunteer and do something great. So we know them, and we in Ukrainian Action welcome them, by the way. But yes, I live here for 8 years, and I'm settled here. I have two children. I live in Dublin, 18. So yeah, I've been a while here, and just a response to this horrible war on about second week of war, I understood that just occasional actions to do something, to help something is not enough. So now we need to do something bigger than that. And I was lucky to meet the team, the Ukrainian Action team. And yeah, here we are.
When the survey respondents were asked about the impact of war, 44% said that war actions such as bombings happened or are still happening in their cities. 17% said they have nowhere to return to because their homes are damaged or ruined. The Russian army has occupied the cities of 15% of the respondents the survey did reveal. The issue of privacy, that is noted in the shared accommodation. It was brought up where strangers are sharing rooms. Many respondents said that they had brought their home currency with them as they fled, and not being able to convert the money along the way, and they have found that they cannot convert it to euro when they get here. Just how common is that problem with the conversion?
I wouldn't expect it to be too common. However, of course, people, I think they came with local currency, and many didn't have even the thought problem, but they didn't realize that they can't convert it here. Honestly, I was surprised with those messages even, because I, 8 years in Ireland, I didn't know that myself because I've never tried. So I wouldn't know the full extent, because maybe not all people said this. But if we would just judge by the frequency of occurrence in the server responses, I wouldn't say it's too frequent. I wouldn't say every second person came with the cash hryvnia, but definitely several people mentioned it as a challenge.
Sticking with finances here, a lack of understanding about Ireland's taxation system was something that was raised, being unable to confidently calculate net pay from gross pay. That was also a difficulty for lots of people. Getting a bank card, that's also been a problem, often because of a lack or loss of documentation, which is obvious. If you're fleeing somewhere, you're not going to be, you know, all organised and have all your ducks in a row. Changing addresses and the language barriers also have affected that. 70% of respondents hadn't got a bank card as a result. Almost three quarters of Ukrainians in Ireland are willing to actively contribute to the economy. Half of them are seeking a job, but nearly 80% of those looking for a job, they don't have a bank account or a bank card. So that's going to be basically impossible, I guess, to get the job set up if you don't have a bank account.
Yeah, that was one of the biggest findings in this survey, because we never realized how big of an impact, like we never even realized the connection between the two. And when we looked at the numbers, we understood that maybe some employers, they would be flexible to allow an employee to start working. However, like that is a challenge. And yeah, we found it, and now we're sharing this awareness that this is something that hopefully banks maybe can look into, like the processes for Ukrainians.
We know in particular many men stayed back in Ukraine, and it's noted here some people can't work because they're single parents of young children. A huge amount of those would be single mothers. Half the respondents are mothers here alone with their children. Two-thirds of those are married but are single mothers here because their husbands are fighting back in Ukraine. Just how much difficulty are those having who are single parents in the country?
Well, I think they're the same difficulties as single parents in Ireland facing, because just because of the speed of the documents, you know, they're allowed the temporary protection document and other documents, the PPS number, they are done quickly. So then they can avail of job market, but in fact they can't, because if you add the cost of childcare or the after school care to the cost of rent that they will need to cover, et cetera, it just makes it very hard. Also, the availability of child care. We have responses, we have quite a few responses from remote locations saying that it just the logistic doesn't work out, like they can't make it work between schools or crèches and workplace, like they just can't make it happen. So, yeah, single mothers, it's very, very hard for them to integrate and to settle, just because they have the duty of caring for children and it's hard to do anything else.
Next, we're going to be speaking, my next guest is the chair of the Federation of Early Childcare Providers, about, you know, clarity they're looking for from the Irish government. But language barriers in childcare are also proving a barrier to employment. If we just focus on childcare in particular, Elena, what's the story in terms of people, I guess, finding suitable places for their children?
Our survey deliberately didn't focus on that topic, because we will probably run another one focusing around children. So the biggest challenge is, of course, the cost. So that's by far the challenge that can hardly be managed by a Ukrainian fleeing the war, unless they found a job that matches their qualification and skill set and the job can pay for childcare. But I'm yet to find that example. The biggest challenge is the cost, because it's not possible to cover the cost with a job on a not qualified profession.
People fleeing the war have set up a home across this country, some in very remote areas, and public transport, that has been an issue also. The road safety in remote areas was mentioned in the survey response, with respondents saying they're not able to walk on the roads, especially with their children, and then public transport to try and maybe potentially get to a workplace, that's also an issue.
Yes, it's one of the biggest ones. Yes, it's a big challenge, yeah.
And just how are people managing that at the moment?
I guess at the moment they understand that accommodation is the key issue for everyone, that Ireland accepted enormous amount of people fleeing the war from Ukraine, and the accommodation that Ireland could provide is something to be grateful for. So those challenges with remote locations and inability to work, they seem secondary to the fact that they are provided with accommodation, that accommodation is safe, that accommodation will hopefully stay there until people need it. So as you can see, there is a conflict of interest. From one point of view, people want to contribute, they want to work, they want to contribute to the economy. And even one of the responses you can remember, we want to pay back. Like, that's definitely a trend there. People want to pay back, they want to contribute to the economy and pay taxes rather than receive the welfare payments. However, those obvious reasons, being in remote locations, not having access to jobs, and not even being able to get to jobs in the lack of public transport, well, that's all on the way. So basically every individual needs to find their own way through it, their own journey.
I think it's important just to remind people, you know, the Ukrainian refugees have been so thankful to Ireland. You noted it at the beginning of the interview, but there was also some complaints in terms of the survey response that translators hired by social services had an unfriendly attitude. That's in quotes there. So I just want to point that out to our listeners. Also, finally, Elena, many Ukrainians want to know what will happen in a year's time when the temporary protection they're afforded here expire. They know, you know, the challenges. They don't want to appear ungrateful. They note here all challenges seem irrelevant compared to the first few days of war, but the anxiety around what will potentially happen next when this temporary protection does expire or elapse is something that I'm sure is a major worry to the forefront of their minds.
With all honesty, we didn't receive too many of those questions, just because people understand that temporary protection is provided for the time of war. So, of course, some people are really worried about, especially the ones you saw that 16% of our respondents, their house is ruined or severely damaged. It means that they don't have where to come back. It means that they need to decide for themselves whether they stay and do every effort to integrate here or whether they still want to go back to Ukraine and find a new place or whatever it is they are to do. So they are lost, basically. And yes, of course, a bit more maybe confidence in what's going to happen next after a year would help them to understand. However, I have to say that it wasn't the vast majority of responses. Yes, it's something of a question. Yes, it would be great to know more about that, but that wasn't the biggest challenge for people.
Okay, I greatly appreciate you coming on and discussing that with me. That's Olena Redruhina. She's the co-founding director of the Ukrainian Action in Ireland. Really interesting survey results there. You can find out more information. We will have it on kfmradio.com in the next few minutes or so. And I have received a couple of emails from people, and Joe has said, so they didn't bring important documents and papers, but they brought cash and cats and dogs. Yeah, I think you'll find, Joe, that some people's pets are, you know, absolutely part of the family, and one of the first things that you'd make sure you have packed. I don't know if my birth cert or finding exactly where that may be in my house would be the top of my list if I was fleeing a country that had been invaded. But thank you very much for that email this afternoon. I am joined now by the chair of the Federation of Early Childcare Providers. That is Elaine Dunn. Elaine, how are you?
I'm good, thank you.
So,
and thank you for having me on.
You're very welcome. We heard from the Taoiseach yesterday at the National Economic Dialogue. He did say that childcare fees could be cut before Christmas. And we know that a lot of childcare providers are threatening to close for a number of days this autumn. That is if a fee freeze is introduced. Tell us a little bit more about this.
Well, to be fair, it's not only about the fee freeze, it's about the ECC services, the small services that run for 3 hours every day. They're open all across the country. They are in rural and urban communities, and they service communities. And we're going to see an awful lot of them closing this time next year because they have not been made a part of the core funding. They've been given very, very little from core funding. And some of them aren't even going to break even, but the department have now said that they're going to help them to break even. Okay, so they're going to give them the funding to break even to the same rate of funding to last year. So we all know that the rate of inflation is now, at, what's it, 7.8?
I think so.
The highest in 32 years. And where these services don't have fees from parents, don't have any funding coming in from parents whatsoever. They're fully government funded. So these service types would have only had one fee increase in 12 years from the government.
So this is confusing to everybody because the Taoiseach has said that measures to cut costs for parents will be introduced. This is before Christmas, so in 2022. But there was a failure to provide any further details. So what potentially could that further detail be? Could we read between the lines there, Elaine? Have you read between the lines? Are there lines to read between?
So there's a new core funding, okay, that's coming. It will be introduced in September. So this new core funding, if you sign up for this core...
221 million euro, right?
Right, 221 million euros. So I'll go into the details of it. So what happens is if you agree to take this core funding, you agree to freeze your fees for this year. Okay? But the problem is the core funding that they've introduced this year is at the rate of inflation of last year. So everything has gone up hugely for service providers. So potentially freezing our fees this year is going to cause damage to these businesses. So we're already at the moment, we've seen, I actually found out yesterday, there's a large full day care service gone in North Dublin. That's three gone in North Dublin in the last 6 weeks of full day care services. So that's quite worrying. And then the smaller services around the country now starting to close as well because they are not sustainable. So if we want this core funding, we must agree to this, the freeze of your fees, which is ridiculous at this time when everything else is going up. And we don't know where the rate of inflation by the end of this year is going to, you know, what's it going to end up at. So for our Taoiseach to come out and say this. I mean, really and truly, he needs to come out and meet with the people on the ground. We have a big protest in Dublin tomorrow outside Leinster House at 11:30, and I would invite our Taoiseach out to come in, you know, and talk to the providers on the ground, because we won't be here for much longer at the rate things are going. And he's making promises that I can't see him being able to keep, because a lot of it will be unsustainable by the end of the year.
Yeah, you're expecting yourselves at Federation of Early Childcare Providers for hundreds of creches to become insolvent if the fees are frozen and the cost of running a business continues to rise. If I know you're not going to give out your own personal business, but with your business...
I absolutely will. I can tell you...
I meant the name. I just mean with your business, what is happening for you at the moment? What can you see happening this autumn? Will you yourself close for a number of days if this fee freeze is introduced?
Well, we are calling for the government to take a stand now with us and to do something starting from the protest tomorrow. And if that doesn't happen, then obviously we have to take a stronger stand, and that will mean that service providers will close the doors for 3 days in September, and they will close the doors in October. You know, and that's the way it's going to continue until somebody starts to listen. I mean, we've gone into the department, we've done presentations to the department, emails going back and forward, you know, but we're not actually getting any response as to how they're going to rectify the lack of core funding for these smaller services. So you're talking about the small and average providers. Like, ECC are fully government funded, but they've had one pay increase in like 12 years. So 12 years ago, we would have been charging €75 a week from 9 o'clock to 1 o'clock. And we're now getting €69 from government 12 years later. That's €4.30 an hour. And we added that we have to pay staff and all the costs. It's unsustainable.
That seems to be the main word that has been used by providers like yourselves. That is Elaine Dunn, chair of the Federation of Early Childcare Providers. They're calling for clarity from the government on how they plan to manage to cut costs, which Taoiseach Micheál Martin, did note at the National Economic Dialogue yesterday, and increase funding in the industry. The National Women's Council also spoke at the National Economic Dialogue, and they have called on the government to tackle the cost of living crisis for women. They said in particular investment in childcare, that was one of the main points for them, because a lack of affordable, accessible, quality childcare remains the single biggest barrier to women's equal participation in employment and public life. That is a direct quote there from the head of policy with the National Women's Council, Jennifer McCarthy Flynn, on it. They continue by saying Ireland's current market approach to early years care and education has clearly failed to deliver for women and families. It has resulted in virtually no public childcare provision, which is particularly affecting women in marginalised communities, and high fees continue to place an incredible financial burden on families. They have called on the government to follow best international practice and deliver a universal public childcare model that guarantees access to affordable, quality childcare for parents and better pay and working conditions for early year educators. Okay, new research published today by Safe Food has revealed that people in Ireland would back a ban on unhealthy food advertising to children and adults to tackle the increasing rates of overweight and obesity. 8 in 10 people in this country agree that so-called junk food advertising aimed at children should be banned. That's 80.2%. And nearly 70% of respondents support restrictions on marketing of unhealthy foods to adults. Joining me now to discuss is Chief Specialist in Nutrition with Safe Food, Joanna Da Silva. Thank you for joining me, Joanna.
Good afternoon.
The research has revealed high levels of public acceptance for policies that supported healthier food environments, in particular for children. I believe 1 in 5 primary school children in this country are overweight. That is quite shocking.
Yes, we do know that levels of overweight and obesity have increased. And although they have stabilised over the past few years, and we don't have data for this year or last year yet, we need to keep in mind that once you isolate those statistics by more affluent or less affluent areas, there is actually a social divide. So it's important that we keep working on different policies that could support the population in relation to achieving a healthy weight.
If we focus on children first and in school, there's different things that Safe Food are advocating for, such as things like healthier vending machines and new restrictions on developing fast food outlets near schools. How would that work, Joanna, potential restrictions on any fast food outlets near...
So just to clarify, those are the recommendations that emerge from the research. And it's very important to highlight that the Department of Health is already doing a lot of work at policy level in relation to childhood. We have standards, nutrition standards for funded school meals in place since 2017, ensuring that the food provided in schools aligns with the healthy eating guidelines for Ireland. We have introduced in 2020 standards for hot school meals, and very recently Safe Food DHSC and Healthy Ireland worked on standards for preschool settings. There is a lot of work going on at European level, and Ireland is very involved in relation to food advertising of unhealthy foods. And you mentioned junk foods there, but foods that are high in fat, sugar or salt. So to make sure that that advertising of those foods to children is addressed or limited or banned.
Going back to the survey results here, 9 in 10 respondents endorsed healthy school meals, 91.8% for primary schools and 90.6% for secondary schools. Educating children on food prep skills at all schools, that is, 91.7% back it. 85.3% believe children should receive a minimum of 30 minutes of exercise in school each day. From Safe Food's point of view, what advice, tips, steps could the organisation take to ensure that children are receiving that 30 minutes?
Well, I think we need to talk about activity as a whole, and we do promote through our START campaign active lifestyles. We can think about active travel, for example, walking to school or getting out of the bus at an earlier stop to promote that, to make sure that children engage with physical activity at school. That's important too. But again, it's to make sure that every time that the opportunity arises for physical activity, also within the family context, that we engage the child in physical activity. So walking, cycling, dancing at home, and then, of course, the element of the physical activity in school.
Moving to adults now, in general, in terms of the survey findings, 47.3% think portion sizes in restaurants and fast food outlets should be restricted as a measure to address obesity. How would something like that, with yourselves at Safe Food, be put in place? Because doesn't it depend from restaurant to restaurant and outlet to outlet?
So first of all, it's important that we are all aware of what a portion is. And we have guidance in Ireland in relation to different food groups and different serving sizes for each type of food. We can do that through awareness campaigns too. But it's also about understanding that we need different portions and proportions of food in our diets, and to make sure that we align our diets with the guidelines.
Very surprisingly, we would have touched on this before, Joanna, but previous research by yourselves at Safe Food had estimated that overweight and obesity was costing Ireland's economy approximately €1.6 billion per year. That's in direct and indirect costs. So one can understand how it's going to benefit everybody to have the majority of people in this country backing a healthier lifestyle if possible. 80% of people, again, in terms of the survey just published, have recognised that obesity poses a serious public health challenge. Joanna, I've had clinicians on before speaking about obesity and how it is down to people's genetics at times. And if that's the case, what hell can Safe Food give, I guess, to those who physiologically, due to their genetics, are living with obesity and overweight?
So absolutely. It is an extremely complex issue, and you have elements of genetics, biology, you have the food environment. So there are no easy solutions to complex problems. And people can live very healthily in different body sizes. And it's about what's the best weight for each one of us. So what we promote is healthy lifestyles and making sure that we achieve our best level of fitness for ourselves, and that we engage with food, and that we eat healthy diets. But that doesn't mean that we are all going to be a certain weight or a certain size. As I said, it's a complex issue, and it needs a combined approach, and that's policy, that's public health campaigns, that's our own responsibility too, and that's programs like reformulation where governments work with industry, for example.
Well, thank you very much for your time this afternoon. That is Joanna Da Silva. She's Chief Specialist in Nutrition with Safe Food. New publications or new research has been published today by Safe Food. 1 in 5 primary school children in this country are overweight, and 4 in 5 people in Ireland agree so-called junk food advertising aimed at children should be banned. Again, 69.4% of respondents support restrictions on marketing of unhealthy foods to adults also. Thank you so much, Joanna.
Thank you.